Hi, Carrie.
How are you?
Not bad. I'm really excited about doing a dialogue with you.
Me too.
I
guess
treat.
We should introduce ourselves. I'm Carrie Howley from Reason Magazine.
I'm Raihan Salam of the Atlantic Monthly and the American Scene and the New America Foundation.
And this is Blogging Heads.
Yes, what fun. So, it turns out that Carrie and I are actually really good friends and have known each other for many, many years.
Yeah, for 3 years we have not agreed on anything. And
yeah, no,
I think this will be yet another dark episode in my failed attempts to bring Raihan from the other side.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because I think that we also have very different styles, because Carrie is actually very kind of reasonable and also very knowledgeable, whereas I
don't
actually
know about
like
that.
To use my Svengali-like powers to hypnotize people into agreeing with me, for example, by swaying my head back and forth, as the classic sort of Indian.
And I won't even be able to see you hypnotizing the viewers, so I'm at a huge
disadvantage.
It's
actually very frustrating. So, Carrie, tell me a little bit about what's been preoccupying you lately, kind of your core concerns.
Well, if we want to make things ugly as soon as possible, I guess we were going to talk about the Clintons.
That's a wonderful idea, yeah. The Clintons.
Yeah.
Now, you have a kind of quirky take on Hillary Clinton, is my understanding. I mean, Hillary Clinton, who is a kind of dangerous authoritarian who wants, for example, to determine what is going to be in my bento box, you evidently think that she is actually a kind of a striking a blow for liberty.
I do. I mean, perhaps that window has closed, but I had been arguing in a recent op-ed that a certain stripe of progressive woman was right to be concerned that this might not be how we want a woman to first come to power. For instance, there's the argument that, yes, we want a woman president, but not this way. And I just sort of was offering some historical perspective. This is very often the way women come to power. You
By
need
this
those
way,
structural
you mean,
advantages.
Because she had a husband who was president earlier on?
Are you giving background on Hillary Clinton?
Oh, no. No, touche. You make a good point. Sorry about that.
anyway. So, the first three senators to serve in the U.S. Senate were both essentially replacing their husbands. I think nine of the first 12 women in the House were either replacing their husbands or were the daughters of heavy politicos. And sort of the argument then is that women essentially... This has long been the way they've blazed the path, and we shouldn't just kind of roll our eyes and wait for better. I mean, we don't want to be absolutist about it if this is just essentially the mechanics of progress.
I think that makes a lot of sense. My small objection is that I think that, the different ways that the dynasty argument's been deployed, I think that the Clinton campaign, and with good reason, is kind of resentful of this idea that she shouldn't be considered by virtue of, this Bush-Clinton
mm-hmm.
sort of, kind of set of reversals. And I think that makes sense. I mean, if she is the best person to do the job, she's the best person to do the job. But at the same time, the Clinton campaign has been deploying this notion that she served in the White House and that this constitutes valuable experience. This indeed constitutes more valuable experience than Barack Obama's experience.
Mm-hmm.
In the State House, et cetera. And my problem with that is that, of course, her role in the White House was not an accountable role. And I think that if, for example, you had a primary campaign between Barack Obama and Ira Magaziner, who was also heavily involved in the healthcare process, he was also someone who had a tremendously varied mm-hmm. career, a very impressive professional career, as Hillary Clinton did prior to ever having served in the Clinton White House. But again, after the healthcare debacle, he left. So if Hillary Clinton were running on the grounds that I have experience of kind of poorly running this kind of healthcare process for 18 months, I thus have this expertise that Barack Obama lacks, that's why you should elect me. I don't think that people would find that to be a very kind of compelling case. And that, of course, is not the case she's making. So that's what, kind
right.
of makes me...
I mean, I think there's definitely been an attempt to sort of harken back to the Clintonian nostalgia when it's convenient and then draw back from it when it's not. But at the end of the day... The reason that we're in this moment is because Hillary Clinton is Bill Clinton's wife. And I actually think that's hurt her. I mean, it's very hard to be a candidate for change if you are essentially a legacy, if this is essentially nepotistic.
Well, one thing I'm curious about is, I mean, so why do you think it's particularly good for women to have a female president? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this idea of the ultimate glass ceiling, et cetera. I mean, I'm curious about that.
Well, I think a lot of the discrimination we see at this point is very subtle. It's something that's really hard to address with policy. You know, little things, well, not little things, but stuff that social psychologists tell us about the fact that it's very difficult for people to see women as both competent and likable. You're put in one or two boxes. You are competent and cold, or you are incompetent but warm and likable. And certainly we have seen Hillary struggle through that. I mean, she's constantly being referred to as a robot. She's frigid. Even Katie Couric was harping on that. And so there's, like, nowhere to go. I mean, the androgynous space isn't really one that's open to her.
Interesting. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. What worries me is that, you know, when you talk about these dynasties in other contexts and the mechanics mm-hmm. of kind of female progress, mm-hmm. You know, and I think of, you know, my family's from Bangladesh, and Bangladeshi politics are dominated by the so-called two begums. These two women have been in a kind of ferocious kind of mm-hmm. struggle for power. And it's actually very interesting the way this ferocious struggle for power has happened, because, you know, literally it'll be a situation where we don't recognize the legitimacy of this election. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just very kind of incredibly ferocious. I first don't think that has very much to do with, you know, the fact that these are two women, but it is interesting mm-hmm. in the context of, for example, what the Clintons have said about the fight for delegates and about mm-hmm. how mm-hmm. they're willing to take, you know, incendiary steps, including fighting for delegates from Michigan and Florida to be seated. And it's interesting to me the kind of parallel and how this may or may not relate to the kind of ferocity of dynastic politics. And then, you know, you have Julian Bond saying, you're disenfranchising minority voters, and Al Sharpton saying something else, and, you know, of course you're going to have these proxies, you know, saying these different things, and just what it does to the tenor of politics. And again, you know, it's not like this is a new tenor or anything like that, and it certainly has nothing to do
with Clintonian
as far as tenor. I can tell, sex differences.
And they are hard to separate. I mean, I think Maureen Dowd was making the argument that, you know, this isn't about women, this is about Clinton. She's not a woman, she's a Clinton. It's like a Fig Newton argument. And I'm not really I mean, that's just too simple. I mean, it's about both. And my interest in this actually also stems from Asia. I mean, Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the female hero of a very paternalistic culture, patriarchal culture, she's where she is because her father, Aung San, was a hero of Burmese independence. And that just sort of makes you realize that the sort of road to humanizing female leaders isn't as clear or obvious as we might like it to be.
Yeah, I was actually reading this neat Pankaj Mishra essay about the sort of recent disturbances in Burma, mm-hmm. quote-unquote. I mean, that's a kind of horrible way of characterizing it. And it was really interesting because his argument, I think, paralleled stuff that I think you've said in the past, namely that when you're talking about the sanctions regime, you're only talking about a Western sanctions regime.
Right.
And if anything, it's actually, you know, perhaps strengthened the SPDC because it's actually strengthened, for example, China's role and also other governments, including, you know, quasi-democratic governments in the region that are actually quite happy to sort of collaborate with that government. Do you think that that's a fair characterization?
I do. I mean, at the same time, I don't want to argue for harsher sanctions because this is a regime that I think is quite happy to be isolationist, to be xenophobic. Yes, you have these relations with China that a lot of people have, they want to suggest that Burma is sort of doing China's will, but that's not true at all. I mean, the Burmese leadership is actually incredibly skeptical of China due to past support by the Chinese for minority tribes during the Civil War. But I guess what I'm saying is when you're in Burma, the sanctions are clearly silly. I mean, they're just a constant source of antagonism. They give the government reason to constantly be putting out anti-U.S. propaganda, to constantly be suggesting that Burma is next on the list of U.S. targets. and whip up this paranoia and sort of cultural narcissism.
That sounds right to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because I think that he made a really strong case that the sanctions are doing the exact opposite of what we want them to do, and that actually, you know, if you imagine the kind of reform path that Burma would likely have taken over the last decade had there been no sanctions, it would have looked very different. It's just sort of like, yeah, one more case of unintended consequences.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure. I mean, I've heard a lot of anti-sanctions people argue that, like, thousands of women have been thrown into prostitution due to the sanctions. I actually think, I mean, that would be convenient to argue. I think that it's had a pretty minimal effect because investment was so small before the sanctions. And that's why they were so easy to impose politically as well.
So, I mean, how do you feel, what do you think is like the likely way forward? I mean, do you think that, certainly in terms of making progress in Burma, I mean, what do you think is going to be the lever, if there is going to be progress, that would make that happen?
I'm not an expert on this, but people who I very much respect have suggested that the only way we're going to see progress is by encouraging liberal elements within the Tamadaw, within the military. Mm-hmm. And apparently there are some liberal progressive, you know, relatively progressive elements within, but they've kind of been beaten down, and it doesn't help them when the government can constantly be pointing to the U.S. as an antagonist, and going on about cultural imperialism, et cetera, et cetera.
One thing I know that we've kind of clashed on in the past is this whole idea of policies relating to family and children.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, you know, kind of you. It's certainly been in the news a fair bit recently, and I'm curious as to some of your thoughts. I know that you actually recently saw a documentary on the subject.
I saw a documentary called Demographic Winter, which was very interesting. It was about the demographic crisis that some fear we're about to face because women are reproducing at insufficient numbers. And actually, I mean, this is really your area, so I think you are genuinely concerned about the decline in fertility. Why don't you tell us what your deepest, darkest fears are in that sphere.
It's interesting. I mean, we were you sent me a really neat article, which I haven't actually finished entirely, but it appeared in The Nation, and it was just talking about this idea that concerns over fertility reflect this kind of very dark this very dark right-wing kind of racialized kind of hysteria about the changing composition of the population and related issues. And I thought it was interesting. I mean, it was also talking about the kind of fascist origins of a lot of kind of population planning policies. And it's interesting because, of course, you know, one could talk about the fascist origins of kind of many public policies that are broadly popular today. And it's certainly true that if you look in a lot of, you know, advanced industrial states that we think of as generally pretty pleasant places to live, France, many of the Nordic countries, et cetera, are countries that have embraced, you know, what one can characterize as pronatalist policies. Quebec is another place. We don't kind of imagine, you know, Poutine eating jackboot wearing
right.
kind of Quebec
wall
fascists.
I mean, that was certainly my thought reading that particular article, which I enjoyed but did sort of portray natalism as particularly coming from an anti-abortion, pro-family sort of very far right. And,
yeah.
I mean, I would think that what would be most likely in our particular society as far as incorporating elements of natalist policy would be more something like the Swedish model. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. And, in fact, I actually think that there are certain aspects of it that, you know, kind of as you suggest, I do find really attractive. The main, you know, sort of idea is that, you know, are people having as many children as they want to have? There seem to be a lot of kind of barriers to this, including the sort of incredibly high cost of raising children. That high cost is also borne disproportionately by women. And that seems, you know, to me at least, pretty unfair. And so if we could somehow try to mitigate those costs, now those costs manifest themselves in a lot of different ways, and one of the ways they manifest themselves seems to be through kind of cultural practices that are pretty strongly embedded that, you know, kind of I would argue, actually bias employment markets and also certain kinds of postgraduate instruction, et cetera, toward, you know, kind of what some have called a kind of male model of employment, you know, kind of one sort of, you know, enters the workforce and sort of is in the workforce on, you know, in an uninterrupted fashion for a very long period of time.
Can we just talk about, though, what, I mean, I'm really interested in this question of total desired fertility. I mean, I think what you're referring to is essentially you ask women how many kids they want and they say two.
Oh, it's very thorny. It's very thorny, and it also varies pretty dramatically across different societies. What does it really mean? I mean,
right.
So you could say that, well, we should only care about the revealed preference. But, I mean, I do think that, honestly, this is a very kind of tricky area. And
absolutely.
I think that it has some resonance. For me, when I think about, you know, some of my peers or friends of mine who are a little bit older than I am, and they're thinking about, you know, yeah, I mean, how many children they want to have and how many children they can realistically have given their kind of social expectations and what have you. And of course, one can just say, as one can say in many aspects of public policy, suck it up or move to a kind of lower cost metropolitan area.
I'm not sure
there are
that
a lot
that's
of different
the response.
Options.
I mean, you might ask, women say that they want two children but then do not go on to have two children. Now,
yeah.
Okay, so the revealed preference is not two. And it's possible that when they're saying two in the initially, that might be a socially conditioned response.
Or it could be that they're naive, or it could be that they don't actually understand, and perhaps after having one child they decide, you know what, I'd rather not have two. But then there are also other studies where you're looking at, you know, women and men who are older, you know, for example, at the age of 40, how many children do you wish you would have had? I mean, again, you know, this retrospective stuff, I understand that it's very thorny, but I do think that it's kind of useful. It's also useful when you see it, for example, in the context of the German-speaking world, where actually their total desired fertility is actually very, very low.
Right, and it's been going down. You have this cascade effect. So what that might suggest is that when women see that it's possible not to have children, they actually start to desire few of them, and that a lot of the responses you're seeing are potentially just sort of social expectations that we spit out when asked in a poll.
Right, and of course, you know, one could say the exact opposite.
All right, yeah, absolutely.
In the German case, actually, they fall into a kind of catastrophically low fertility, the way that these, you know, kind of alleged kind of right-wing alarmists are talking. I mean, I think that, you know, from my perspective, I guess my core belief is that this sort of idea of demographic vitality, which of course does sound a little creepy, is actually a pretty valuable idea in terms of, you know, kind of the nature of a culture, its relative openness. I mean, when I think about, you know, for example, communities that are dominated by, you know, oldsters who don't want to pay for the public schools, part of the reason they don't want to pay for the public schools is that the kids look different from them. And I think that also sort of society's kind of capacity for innovation. And this is actually something that we're really still figuring out because, you know, for example, Japan is a society that has a lot of technological dynamism, a society that's increasingly relying on robotics and other means to provide companionship and also to provide, you know, kind of basic assistance to very old people. But, you know, my kind of grand kind of issue about the world and thinking about, you know, the world is just this idea that, you know, we had this set of kind of beliefs and institutions that fit humanity reasonably well given a certain kind of historical institutional context. For example, Christianity grew incredibly, incredibly fast during the late Roman Empire. And part of why, you know, it happened to kind of match up with what, you know, kind of a certain kind of society needed. It also sort of people were healthier. They were more likely to survive because of this idea of fellowship and what have you. In, you know, kind of the cities at the time, I mean, which were, of course, a pretty small slice of the population, but, you know, diseases would wipe out huge slices of the population very, very regularly, and the Christians tended to survive better than the others. So I think that, you know, kind of now people like me who are, you know, kind of pretty secular and what have you are trying to kind of stumble around and inch toward a kind of new way of living and a new way of kind of figuring out, you know, what are going to be our institutions and family arrangements. And I don't think we've done a really good job, and I think that it's going to be something we're going to be working on for decades. So I think about how, like, a couple of people have kind of reached this consensus where, you know, they're not, it's not necessarily very happy or kind of fulfilling, you know, kind of far fewer children are being born. Is that the kind of right balance? And what are the new ways that we ought to think about these issues? And again, I actually believe that we're all going to be replaced by super intelligent robots.
Oh, we absolutely are.
In the future.
Which is, I mean, so, we need to make sure everyone has capital before the robot economy, Robin Hanson's robot economy takes over.
Yeah, no, I think that that's certainly an issue that I care about. So, again, maybe this is all going to be moot, and sort of all these kind of questions about human nature and relationships and marriage and what have you. But, I mean, I think that they're certainly interesting, so that's why I spend a lot of time thinking about them.
Yeah. No, I'm definitely interested in, I mean, I do feel like the Natalist Project is to reconstruct society in such a way that the constraints on children are less. Thus, women will choose to have more children. But you can really manipulate any desire in that way. And so it's like, why are we going to restructure society in order to encourage women to procreate rather than simply restructure society in order to deal with declining fertility? And the answer to me, I mean, the answer as far as which course we should take isn't obvious to me.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that, you know, one could characterize it as kind of a set of policies that are working together in a kind of, you know, dysfunctional way to kind of discourage fertility. So I think that, you know, kind of, you know, it's kind of hard to disentangle this stuff. And I think that, you know, kind of sometimes this stuff is polemically deployed. I mean, I'll be very frank and say that, you know, I actually do think that a society with more young kids is better than the alternative, a society with very, very few of them. Now, I could be totally wrong about this, but my sense derives in part from this idea of, you know, what does childbearing teach you? And I actually think of this less as a kind of female-male issue, though, of course, you know, kind of that is certainly, you know, kind of a very, very important piece of it. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I would, you know, perhaps it's going to be men who are going to be cloning themselves. Perhaps it's going to be sort of, you know, same-sex couples reproducing in some other kind of unconventional way. I mean, you know, this is stuff that, you know, kind of is unfamiliar territory. But, you know, bracketing those questions, which is, of course, really hard to do, you know, kind of do we want more young kids? And do we want more adults who kind of are, you know, have young kids as kind of part of their lives? And I think that the kind of forbearance that having children teaches you, I think that it's something that kind of informs the society. And I think that that's something that we're in danger of losing as you see fewer and fewer households with children under the age of 18. Now, again, that's all really speculative and, of course, very controversial. So,
I mean, there's certainly going to be a rhetorical difficulty. I mean, this is a particular agenda that's so easily co-opted by people who essentially want the right kind of people to be ascendant, to be created. It's very easily attached to nationalist agendas. So you can see how the Nation could publish an article quite reasonably decrying this as a far-right phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, except that I think that, you know, they also, I think, pretty unfairly mischaracterized, you know, my friend Phil Longman and some of his kind of concerns and considerations. I mean, I think that, you know, when you're I think that actually one of Longman's concerns, which makes, you know, some sense from his perspective as someone who is, you know, kind of a broadly kind of secular, kind of left-of-center guy, is that actually the groups that you see reproducing themselves successfully and the groups that you see actually bearing greater kind of weight in future generations is a group that, you know, believes in revealed religion, is
right.
A group that actually sort of, you know, embraces kind of the patriarchy. And so, you know, kind of there's this risk that, you know, kind of tolerant, secular liberal types you know, will be
outbred,
you know,
badly
outnumbered. And, you know, there's... Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Go ahead. I thought you were done.
Well, there's actually also this really neat article that appeared, I think it was in the Times Magazine, about the Syrian Jewish community, a community that actually, you know, really strongly engaged in shunning and other practices that are kind of pretty unfamiliar to those of us who live in a kind of urban, secular, liberal, tolerant, you know, kind of place. And they're just doing incredibly well. They're flourishing demographically. And it's interesting to think of the Syrian Jews as, you know, kind of a portent for the future and what the world is going to look like.
Do you think that's likely, given rates of secularization?
Well, I mean, I actually think that, you know, when you're talking about secularization, you're talking about a lot of different sort of dynamics that are cutting in different directions, and you see sort of some cases where actually see people becoming a lot more religiously observant, but of course that religious observance, you know, for example, people who describe themselves as really secular in like Egypt, you know, kind of as you know, are, you know, a lot more religious than people who consider themselves really religious in the United States.
Right, right.
So I think that, you know,
but
kind of there are a
bunch of that's part of the argument. The goalposts keep shifting. What was considered very conservative in one age is suddenly not conservative in the next. I guess I'm saying I wouldn't really know what it would mean to have an incredibly conservative society in 100 years.
Yeah, and also, you know, that's a really good point. And certainly, I mean, I think that, you know, that's kind of less, again, that's kind of less my, you know, kind of main issue, because actually I would be kind of happy if society, you know, you know, being a conservative were more conservative in some respects.
Oh, dear.
I'm actually
interested, given your support for large families and et cetera, yet you are a supporter of the gender tax proposal that's getting some attention in Spain, by which women would be taxed at a lesser rate given that their labor supply is more elastic, the idea being that they would be pushed into the workforce in greater numbers. You're supportive of
this. Well, I mean, I think that I would characterize myself as someone who's very upset about people saying this is unacceptable and we can't possibly do such a thing. I think that that is a very dangerous idea, because I think that actually we need to have of course, we need to have red lines. We need to have red lines that are built in sort of these ideas of human dignity and sort of what we're willing to do and the kind of, you know, who we're willing to harm. I think that, you know, the idea of kind of shaming a particular group, for example, if shaved-headed, you know, Bangladeshis were certainly kind of persona non grata, I would want us to kind of appeal to, you know, kind of this sort of, you know, rights-oriented sensibility to kind of save, you know, my people. But I also think that, gee, I mean, if this, you know, this is an idea that's out there, and to kind of shut down the discussion by saying this is unacceptable seems really dangerous to me. Now, is this particular idea the right one? I mean, I'm not sure. It certainly sounds interesting and like something that ought to be pursued, and certainly something that I would like to be tried in some jurisdiction so that the rest of us can kind of learn from
it. That's interesting.
So that's kind of like
yeah,
my
I mean,
main
I'm certainly premise. Supportive of the goal in a sort of Linda Hirschman kind of way, where I think there are all these positive effects toward in pursuing that particular end. I guess my initial response would be that I'm kind of uncomfortable with further enshrining a sort of binary concept of gender into the tax code.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's good for autonomy when we consider gender to be a more fluid phenomenon, first of all. But then also, I do think it's best to strive for a certain generality within the tax code. I mean, I don't want my relation to the state to be one of a woman. I'd rather it be just a person and her rights.
I think that totally makes sense. I mean, I always thought of this in the context of, you know, I would love to see legislation where women are not only allowed to carry concealed firearms, but actually, you know, let's say in New York City where I grew up, if, you know, all women above the age of, say, you know, 12 were actually given firearms. And I would be very interested to see what would happen to kind of street crime and also sort of other kind of patterns of violence that, you know, are pretty persistent. I am encouraged by the thought that
you're
maybe,
not scared by the concept of roving girl gangs.
Well, you know, it's interesting because
this is, of course,
you know, really gendered, and I think that we kind of think of this stuff in different ways. But I kind of think that women would generally be pretty sensible about their guns, and they would
Do
also,
you?
You know, kind of discourage non-women from kind of attacking them with the guns. Yeah, I mean, I really
I don't think
do,
you've ever attended an all-girls high school because girls can
that's
be
true,
pretty
also,
terrifying.
I grew up in a female-dominated household.
Oh, you did. That's
kind
true.
Of, the kind of you know kind of essential fact about me. I also think that in the context of, I mean, the gender-based taxation idea. So you know, my sense is that they believe that it will kind of encourage more women to enter the labor force. It's also mm-hmm. interesting because it was the proposal of the kind of right-of-center political party
yeah.
that has been, you know, kind of identified with Franco or sort of, you know, the kind of the after effects, the kind of aftertaste, you might say. So it's interesting because that they would embrace this particular proposal. I think that it's a kind of very arresting and sort of neat idea. It's,
yeah.
it's a sign that kind of the European center-right is kind of trying to think more creatively about public policy. So I think that, you know, in that regard, there are a lot of things that are really attractive, but I would also want it to be balanced because, you know, I really buy into the kind of Catherine Hakim notion that if you're looking at women in any society, particularly industrialized societies, they kind of cluster into different groups in terms of their preferences for balancing kind of work in the home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, this is a proposal that works really well for kind of one of those clusters. It's a, you know, one that doesn't work, you know, quite as well for other clusters. And my hope would be that you would see other public policies that would address these other clusters so that we can have something where we're not pitting one group of women against another group of women, but rather trying to frame policies that are good for all, you know, adults.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that the Spanish leadership recognizes that it's low, the low level of female participation in the workforce is a real drag on growth, as it is in many, many, many places. But I guess I'm worried if you're going to approach all these questions through the sort of optimal tax framework. I mean, there are just a million ways in which you could slice the population demographically and say,
yeah.
this labor supply is less responsive to tax rates, so let's tax, you know, Mormon 75%. I mean, obviously that's outlandish, but you can see how suddenly everyone's going to be grabbing for their subsidy.
That's a really good point because also, you know, yeah, you could say that, I mean, that's fundamentally arbitrary, so, like, we're not going to use religious groups because we think that's bad.
Right.
But then, wait a second, why are you using women or why are you using some other category, you know, or, like, you know, oh, that's a subaltern group, so you can't do that. Yeah, I think that, you know, or imagine if they started taxing ethno-racial groups at different rates.
Right.
You know,
right.
for example, you know, my parents both, the whole time I was growing up, they both worked, like, two jobs.
Yeah, illegal immigrants would be another, like, great sort of place to hit if you're just looking to maximize tax revenue.
Selective colleges and universities, I mean, were accused of doing this. The University of Chicago was accused, I believe, of actually kind of giving less generous financial aid packages to Asian parents
oh,
on
wow.
the grounds that, oh, hell, they're going to do it. I mean, this was, you know, ages ago. And, yeah, I mean, that's certainly – so, yeah, why does that strike as a sinister rather than, you know, kind of taxing women a little bit less? But, you know, my kind of sense is if you're taxing women less, I'm kind of pretty comfortable with punishing men in different regards, because I think that I often punish myself by beating myself.
Well, see, my real, like, worry is that the sort of Raihan, Salam, Natalist agenda is going to take over, and they'll all just start taxing us horribly, punishingly, so that we'll all stay home and make babies. So,
well, I think that well,
that's
and
the
also
real worry.
Then we would recreate this kind of wonderful household production economy where, for example, I would be constructing amazing things out of Legos and I would be whittling in the corner. And I think that would actually be kind of nice. But again,
well, that does sound lovely, you know, actually.
On second thought.
I'm convinced.
well, I guess we've resolved that. So let's
you
see.
Win.
Well, how about, I mean, so it's Valentine's Day.
It is.
Which is a day, I mean, I actually, you know, barely know when Valentine's Day is happening. To my sort of great chagrin and embarrassment, my only Valentine's Day greeting today was from my mother, who, you know, kind of, happy Valentine's Day, Britu. you know, it was very sweet of
That's
her.
That's adorable.
I've got to say, I mean, I'm incredibly cynical about Valentine's Day and about romance more broadly.
Really?
I think that it's,
are you cynical
you know, yeah.
because it's a fake holiday that's been foisted upon you by Hallmark? Or
well, that too, but
reasons?
I also, honestly, I'm a lot more on a much deeper level because I really believe that sort of as an agent of the super intelligent robots to come, I do think that actually sort of watching these humans sort of get together and relate to each other, fall in love and what have you, I mean, I think that this is only delaying the rise of our robot overlords, who, by the way, I firmly endorse. So I think that, yeah, we need to stop. We need to cut out with I know this directly contradicts everything I've said up to this point, but I think that, you know, immediate end to all procreation.
Okay.
And sort of goo-goo
eyes. Because if we procreate, we are serving their agenda.
No, you know what? Actually, one thing I just want to throw out there is
okay.
Sort of PDAs. I mean, this is something I fear I'm going to see a lot of when I go out on the street. Unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable. I mean, how people think it's appropriate to smooch in public.
Oh, that kind of PDA.
I mean, it's just sort
okay.
of, oh, my God. Yeah, exactly. Not personal digital assistant. Although that is
like,
another kind of PDA
I
that
didn't,
I haven't experienced.
I don't remember us discussing beforehand an anti-BlackBerry rant, but that would be
well,
fine,
so,
too.
I mean, so, I mean, how do you feel about it? I mean, sort of, you know, kind of you know, people buying each other things. I mean, just sort of, I care about you. I purchased you something. I mean, ugh, good grief. It makes me want to take a bath.
You know, it's funny that you see a lot of concern about this particular holiday in countries like Kuwait. Because as I've mentioned before, it seems to me that Valentine's Day is not the day in which you have your extramarital affairs. It's the day in which you have to turn back to your previous commitments, no matter how
or
empty
so
they
you
are,
say.
And yeah. embrace them.
Well, that's actually...
So I actually think it's a quite conservative holiday.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, that certainly makes sense to me. But I mean, I guess I don't know what is it about. Well, you know, you kind of mentioned a really wonderful essay that I then had the pleasure of reading about marriage and the idea that marriage has evolved as a kind of way to consume together. And you know, when I think about Valentine's Day, and I just think about, you know, it's interesting because when I think about my close friends and about also people I've kind of drifted apart from in various ways, people I've become closer to, I always think of that in the context of attitudes toward consumption. And I guess that's a reflection
mm-hmm.
on a kind of post-industrial society, that the way that we kind of frame these choices become incredibly weighty. I mean, I know when I know that someone else likes, for example, three of the bands that I like,
mm-hmm.
we're going to get along. I mean, we're almost certainly going to be friends. And this depresses me. This depresses me also as a fact about kind of modern mating.
Because you think there's a lack of diversity in sort of assortative mating type framework?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, not only that, but also, I mean, sort of this kind of totally terrifying idea that assortative mating is actually having these kind of weird outcomes in terms of the rise in autism and what have you. The idea that actually somehow some mysterious force is whispering in our ears telling us that, you know, ooh, 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 you know, this is actually really bad somehow, and that, you know, kind of I should... Gosh, you know what I mean? I I'm an incredibly demonstrative and loud person, and I should be marrying someone like incredibly dour. And you know, I mean, that's something that you know, kind of, I think about sometimes.
Well, I hope you don't. But
I like dour people.
The particular essay to which we're talking about is something that that showed up in K2 Unbound, and was by Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And the argument they were making, which resonated with me, but then. I'm a very particular slice of the population, was that marriage has transitioned from being about production to being sort of a consumption partnership, not consumptive. And
yellow fever. Let's get together of yellow fever together. Yes.
And the idea being that, well, my spin on it is that marriage has been decommodified, whereas once it was, the family was kind of an economic unit. That's no longer necessary, and now we just look for people with whom to share consumption experiences, which is certainly what I look for in a relationship, but then I don't have kids, I have a certain level of material well-being. But I do find it attractive as kind of a model for the future. Although I would think that a lot of conservatives would be comfortable with it because there's this desire to make marriage something that you need to sacrifice for.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, and they actually refer to this pretty thoughtfully in the essay, but I mean, I think that, marriage bonds become less powerful when there's less dependence. I mean, I think about, you know, my parents, and they had an arranged marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, kind of a radical alternative to the kind of thing we're talking about, a real kind of atavistic throwback, you know, one might say. And it's true that, you know, particularly given sort of their peccadilloes and their, you know, kind of the kind of, you know, a lot of the kind of turmoil that they had to kind of work through and overcome, you know, particularly I think my father needed my mother. In fact, mm-hmm. it's actually kind of really hard for me to imagine a world where he would have done as well as he did without my mother. And also, my mother, she made a lot of sacrifices. And to some extent, I mean, I think that informs the ways in which I'm actually really sympathetic with feminism, certainly a certain strand of feminism, just the kind of compromises and the limitations of imposed on her life by kind of the social circumstances of a kind of third world country that had, you know, kind of, you know, radically different expectations from the kind of expectations I'd hope to have if I ever, you know, kind of were allowed to breed, were ever given a license to breed, which let's hope, you know, never happens. So, and they were a production partnership in a lot of ways. And I actually think that there's the possibility that actually might return in some respect. I mean, when we talk about economic insecurity and sort of economic risk, I mean, sort of one of the great kind of insurance pooling mechanisms is kind of the two-income family. But of course, when kind of social expectation is that you automatically will always and everywhere have two incomes, that, you know, idea of it as a kind of safety net is undermined quite a bit. So, I mean, I wonder if, you know, kind of the Stevens-Wolfers essay, you know, it kind of posits this is directional. We're moving in this one direction. I mean, I wonder if we actually sort of will move in another direction at some other point, sort of given sort of changed economic and demographic circumstances. I think it's a distinct possibility. For example, you know, the kind of welfare state where people are able to outsource caring for their elderly parents to the state via Social Security, et cetera, I mean, is that going to survive? Is that going to last?
Mm-hmm.
Is there going to be some kind of transition? Are we going to become so impossibly affluent that marriage isn't even going to be kind of relevant or interesting?
But don't you think in an affluent society what you will see are these sort of consumption partnerships? I mean, that seems to be, I mean, people do desire to share their experiences. And I think that the argument is that that's what marriage is for in the end.
I think that actually the world of abundance, I think, yeah.
You think
I
there mean, will be abundant partners per person in a world of abundance? I mean, essentially, will stop forming partnerships?
That's less what I mean. But what I mean more is just this idea that, I mean, so much of kind of our concerns and our anxieties are kind of rooted in these kind of post-materialist kind of aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was definitely a big theme of Brink Lindsey's book, something that certainly comes up a lot because it's kind of the central fact of our time. And kind of the thing that I imagine, because I'm a lunatic, is this idea of, you know, if I had a family, like, unschooling my kids. They would just, you know, kind of climb trees all day, and they would never go to school until they were, like, maybe 14, 15. And, you know, kind of I would be making stuff and, you know, hunting, you know, in the forest. And, you know, my wife would be the breadwinner, possibly, and she would be, you know, for example, rubbing sticks together to create fire for us.
I am so excited to come visit the Salaam compound in 20 years.
Well, except that you wouldn't be able to because we wouldn't have barcodes tattooed on our arms the way that everyone else will. So, you know, the GPS system will not be able to identify us.
Oh, man.
We're going to be foraging for nuts and berries and, you know, off the grid style. So, yeah, we're going to be tough to find. Also, I'm going to have an enormously long beard and pretend to be Amish.
I'll smoke you out.
Well, I'm just really hoping that actually we're going to see a lot more kind of experiments in living
mm-hmm.
and that we're going to see some people who are going to try to create recreate, you might say. And again, you know, you could say, well, that's just another more kind of stylized, incredibly, like, funkified version of consumption.
No, I find that really, I mean, yeah, I find that really exciting for that reason. And certainly, I mean, I know you're very positive about alternative ways of schooling, and certainly I think warehousing is not the answer, and we ought to be looking for all these, like, creative alternative modes in which to use different pedagogical theories and that sort of thing. But I do worry about the isolation of children who might be homeschooled. I mean, I feel like there is a conflict between the scope of parental authority and the autonomy of children. And I'm wondering if you feel like that is in any way something that a liberal democracy should concern itself with, or we should all be forming our compounds.
I've actually kind of occupied virtually every position on the spectrum of positions one can have on the set of issues. I remember when I was 19 or 20, my friend, who is a devout Catholic, also from New York, and he was talking about how, like, yeah, I favor school vouchers, and here's why. And then, you know, my friend and I were like, oh, my God, but the religious indoctrination, and, you know, what's going to happen, and these kids are going to be manipulated. And, you know, I just really thought, you know, you need to have a kind of common civic education for everyone, and this kind of lends itself to a kind of diverse society and a democratic society. And then subsequent to that, I was like, well, that's just crazy. And then later, I mean, at one point I was like, let's get rid of all schools, and people strum the banjo and kind of smoke doobie, you know, by the river, this will be much
which
better.
Which is kind of the 70s version of homeschooling, right?
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
that
absolutely.
That was much more
yeah.
about unschooling and free thinking, as far as I know. Yeah. I think you know much more about this than I do, but I feel like that has kind of turned, and now in the 80s and 90s and onward, our conception is one less of more exposure than of parents trying to give their kids less exposure.
Well,
and I have no idea to the extent
happens,
which
yeah.
that is true. I haven't seen, you know, the numbers on why people are homeschooling or what kinds of people are homeschooling. But I do think there is a concern about the autonomy of dependents who aren't being exposed to other modes of living.
Yeah, I think that is very right. I think that, but it's also just, it reminds me of all the debates surrounding kind of multiculturalism and political theory,
mm-hmm.
and this idea that, okay, well, we need to preserve Quebecois culture. We can't let it be sort of ground down by assimilation and what have you. We need the state to intervene and to privilege, you know, kind of this one language because, you know, it's uniquely valuable. It gives people a context of choice. We want to kind of preserve this diversity through kind of institutional means. And then, you know, I was always kind of sympathetic to, and then, you know, kind of you have this other set of arguments that, okay, we need to educate everyone in English and what have you because, you know, we want them to be able to participate in this kind of wider society. We don't want them to be ghettoized. We don't want them to be part of these kind of very oppressive, you know, kind of minority cultures.
Yeah.
So I think that actually it parallels kind of these arguments about homeschooling, the kind of, you know, more broadly the kind of educational system we want. And, you know, kind of my, as a kind of sort of neoconservative, meliorist type, you know, my sense is that we need to do a much better job of educating kids who are disadvantaged by their experiences outside of school. I mean, you're in school for 8 hours
mm-hmm,
a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then all this other part of the day, you know, you kind of, you're dealing with, you know, say, a family that isn't equipped to provide kids with the stimulation that they perhaps need to kind of do well in school. But my hope is that actually the economy is changing in such a way that, you know, the kind of, this narrow kind of school-bound notion of what is success and what is intelligence is
mm-hmm.
actually being radically undermined by the idea that sort of totally different baskets of skills are going to end up being really, really valuable. For example, you know, plumbers can't be replaced by robots. So, you know, the idea of having that kind of intuition is going to be valuable. And I worry about the kinds of intuition and the kinds of intelligence that are actually beaten out of you in school. And, you know, I sometimes think about, you know, my friends who are A students, who are, you know, really brainy, and their limitations and their fears, and the ways they always seek out, you know, I seek out law school, or I'm going to go to this schmancy magazine, but I'm not going to make demands when I'm there, or I'm just going to be very meek and just kind of accept what's given to me.
Right,
because,
well, there's
again,
that,
you know,
paradox of the people
structure.
Who are the most insulated from risk in all of human history seem to be incredibly risk-averse.
Exactly. It's incredible. And, you know, to me, the idea of being, you know, kind of a middle-class North American is this tremendous opportunity to screw up.
Yeah.
Not only to screw up, but to screw up again and again and again, but hopefully to screw up in some way that's like, you know, I'm trying something, I'm grasping at something, I'm trying something new that's going to challenge me in particular, not necessarily kind of, you know, seem neat to my friends, and just this idea of living with courage. And that's kind of what bugs me, I guess, about Valentine's Day, and when I see my generation, the way they, you know, their approach to relationships, the kind of incredible meekness and the kind of undaringness, and also the kind of cult of monogamy for young kids. You know, when I think about, you know, just high school and about, you know, oh, you know, she cheated on me, or like, you know, she cheated on you. I mean, you're 15, you know, I mean, sort of people smooch and peck other people and people, you know.
That's really interesting. I mean, because I believe you're an advocate of early marriage, am I right?
I am an advocate. Well, what am I, an advocate of early marriage? I mean, yeah.
I mean, for purposes of,
Lori
fertility
Gottlieb's
support,
piece.
Clearly early marriage makes sense.
I love Lori Gottlieb's piece, this idea that actually kind of settling makes sense. So in that sense, I think you're right.
I thought that piece really interesting as well. I mean, I thought it obviously true in some respects, but also I personally am really glad I didn't settle, you know, at a time when I might have been more fertile than I am now. So I can, I think that's kind of dangerous advice at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so how do I reconcile these two things? Well, I mean, the main way I reconcile it is if I had, you know, kids, if I had sort of a bunch of teenage daughters, which is actually like an incredibly bizarre thought, I would be like the most embarrassing dad in the world.
Well, they would never leave the compound, so there'd be no one to be embarrassed by. Oh,
right, no, they'd be like sort of bringing like squirrel carcasses in to be boiled. But I think that, you know, I'd really encourage them, like, holy cow, don't get tied down. I mean, you know, you really want to be popular, and you want to go on a lot of dates, and you don't want to get kind of too serious, but you really want to be like going out on like five different dates with five different dudes. I think that would, and again, like, don't, you know, like, don't, you know, do anything to, you know, do anything I wouldn't do. But I think that, you know, it's just the idea that, you know, kind of, yeah, it's a low threshold thing. This isn't the most important thing in the world. You know, you make mistakes, you meet different people, you kind of figure out what different people are like, and you learn to be a little bit more tolerant of kind of people's quirks and stuff like that. I just think that that is so much better. And then, yeah, when you're like 25, when you're 23, you know, you just have a better sense, you know, I've kind of, tasted many different fruits.
That's really interesting, because I always think of that sort of lack of experimentation and that it's such a shame in terms of fear of material success, not in terms of, you know, romantic success, in that, well, I have to go to law school because I always have to maintain this exact level of consumption.
Yeah.
But when you were talking about schooling before, just to kind of get back on some coherent track, for the last few minutes, I guess it's hopeless
Good
at this
luck.
Point. But you brought up that great analogy. But the analogy between school choice and public schools that always, you know, pops into my head is that there's this argument that we can't talk about vouchers because we don't want to suck all of the best of the best out of the public schools. And for me, alarm bells immediately go off my head as an immigration freak that this is the exact same argument you hear that's sort of cloaked as a brain drain argument, which is that we can't let certain classes of people escape from their countries and come to ours because we are draining those countries of human resources. And I mean, is brain drain a concern of yours? I mean, in this demographic winter movie, the argument is that immigration cannot be a substitute for low fertility because we are then draining developing countries of needed people. I mean, it's a completely absurd argument, but it is kind of wrapped up in the whole nihilism debate.
Yeah. It was like the Germans were saying Kinder, not Inder, and sort of as one of the Inder, I mean, sort of who, just, you know, children and not Indians. I think that it's interesting. I mean, I'm personally worried about the kind of brains being drained out of my body because I'm in an incredibly cold room.
Are you
but
leaking?
I think that... Well, let's not talk about that right now. I'm actually not. Whew. But I think that actually brain circulation is what actually happens.
Right.
And the idea of, like, a bunch of hermetically sealed economies is kind of specious. I mean, you have North Korea,
exactly.
But then you have the rest of the world. And I think that that's, you know, kind of total pap. But I also think, I mean, is there a kind of, for example, you know, my... you know, dad, he went and studied around the world, and then he always intended to come back to his native country, Bangladesh, and kind of help build that country. So is there a kind of personal sadness, you know, given the fact that actually the political turmoil and wrenching poverty and just kind of real fearfulness for his daughters, you know, kind of is what led him to leave. I was actually looking through these statistics about the diversity visa lottery and the number of people who apply from Bangladesh. The number is staggering. It's like, you know, I think around a million people. And when you think about the fact that it's only people who have, I believe it's people who have some... they have to have high school diplomas, there are all kinds of other requirements, they have to have some basic level of literacy, and also each one of those applications is for a family. You know, you think about the number of kind of people who are literate or who have secondary school educations, et cetera, in that country. I mean, it's an enormous slice of that country. Ukraine, the same story. The number of people who kind of are in situations where there's real kind of desperation. And that's what I think, you know, needs to inform the immigration debate. Now, of course, it's what informs, you know, kind of people who, like, want absolutely closed borders. They have the sense that we're going to be invaded by this massive number of people. But it's also something that, you know, kind of tells you about the kind of basic failure of the hermetically sealed economies that we see
throughout
much of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and
tragedy.
I think what people fail to realize is when they're seeing, like, slots being taken from one economy and put into another is that, well, opportunities abroad actually provide incentives to pursue higher education. So you might not have so many nurses in the Philippines ready to leave were those opportunities not available. It's kind of an obvious point, but I feel like it's something that very often gets lost when people are freaking out about brain drain, which certainly, not to suggest that it's not a valid concern, but as you said, it's much more complicated given the interplay of economies.
I also think that, I mean, that's why I kind of always think of this stuff. And this is why I like Danny Roderick. I mean, I have a lot of disagreements with him, but the idea of looking at each of these problems in a very fine-grained way, because we live in a kind of the second-best world. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about sort of, you know, obviously the key thing is having big agglomerations of people who are particularly good at a certain set of things. So that's why, you know, that's the sad thing about our reluctance to kind of admit a lot of kind of talented engineers and scientists, because, you know, we have Silicon Valley. We have this kind of incredibly sophisticated set of capital markets, and we have this cluster of people. And we really want that to be the best agglomeration it can possibly be. There are going to be spillover benefits for the U.S., but also for the world. And I think that's true kind of across a lot of different areas. But then where I think I part company with you a little bit is the sense that if we're looking at this kind of finer-grained question of the United States' relationship with Mexico, which is really at the heart of a lot of the kind of migration debate, kind of some of what I see is, you know, kind of these communities where if women and men both worked, you know, actually they would have roughly the same incomes as they would with men sending their wages back to Mexico, allowing women to not participate in the kind of market economy. And then you have these children who don't have, you know, fathers around. And I think that actually that's created a set of kind of social problems. And I think that, you know, when you're looking at that very kind of nitty-gritty narrow issue, I think that, you know, kind of finer grain policy instruments, you know, would do us some good. So, I mean, this isn't to say this isn't anything dispositive.
I mean, would you consider, though, that the value of the remittance is the entire value of working abroad? I mean, there might be other skills
up.
There might be the opportunity to move, to be upwardly mobile in the future.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you're absolutely right, but again, sort of that there are many reasons one goes, but I think that in terms of skill transfer, given sort of the kind of jobs that, I mean, look, it varies. I mean, there are many individual cases where someone is going to find the skill transfer is tremendously valuable. There are many other cases where that's not the case. And I also think in terms of just raw stability of, like, a particular region, I mean, that's also a legitimate question, and also, like, when you're looking at the lives of these children, and that's a case where, you know, for example, I believe the Civil Rights Act was a good thing because you had a kind of poisonous pattern that existed in kind of large swaths of the country, possibly the entire United States. And I think that, you know, you needed some sort of very heavy-handed policy intervention to kind of disrupt that bad pattern.
Yeah.
So could it be that, you know, for example, in China where, you know, I think that the one-child policy has been a kind of profound disaster, and we're seeing that, you know, in the emergence of kind of, you know, gangs of sort of children. Sort of you're seeing it, you know, kind of without having this, you know, kind of this radical situation where people don't have aunts and uncles, they don't have siblings, they don't have these kind of, like, dense networks.
Talk about demographic disaster.
Yeah, and so I think that that's something that I think about a lot, and the kind of unintended consequences of some of these policies that look at the first cut in terms of the first thing that we're paying attention to. Ah, that will help us kind of raise per capita income. Ergo, we will do this. But, of course, you're affecting, like, a gabrillion other things at the exact same time. So that's why, you know, kind of, I think like you, I mean, it's sort of, I tend to sort of try to be, you know, pretty humble when I'm thinking about kind of large-scale policy interventions. But I guess I'm less shy of them because I do believe that there is place for experimentation. Provided we know the fallout is going to be, you know, contained.
Well, I think we're coming up on our time. Are there any other insane musings on the future you might have to share with us?
Not really. I do want to know, though, about what you're listening to lately, Carrie, very briefly.
What am I listening to? Well, I always return back to my favorite, to Neutral Milk Hotel, which is just kind of the standard, always in my cheap MP3 player, which is not an iPod. What about you?
I've just acquired a bunch of albums the other night, a bunch of Juju, and also the new Say Hi album, formerly known as Say Hi to Your Mom. But actually, I think that what I'm most excited about is Management. They're really, really great. I'm worried that they're too skinny, however. I want to feed them.
They are? Well, that's the price of fame.
No, it's true. It's true. It also reflects my kind of paternalist mindset that I am worried about how scrawny they are. I'm thinking, hey, you guys need to have some pot roast. Or, I'm going to bring you a big pork chop.
I think you should go to a show and bring them a pot roast.
Oh, that would be a little strange, but I'm going to think about it. Well, thanks so much, Carrie. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Excellent. Bye.
Bye.